Good afternoon, members. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. The first order of business will be the approval of the minutes dated March 14th. Representative Greiling moves approval of the...
I move the minutes.
Representative Greiling moves approval of the minutes dated March 14th. Is there any corrections, discussions, additions, or subtractions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have two bills that will be up during our morning session today. The first is Representative Fabian. Representative Fabian, are you ready to go or not?
Yep.
Okay. Representative Fabian, House File 533, and let's see, one. And we're just going to hold off a little bit until we talk about it at all. And Representative Greiling, there is an amendment to the bill that is being copied right now. I can give you a copy of it. It's just
Mr. Chair, is this the one that adds in Representative Purcell's district?
I'll let the author of the amendment address it before we move it or anything like that. So, Representative Fabian, before we formally move the bill, we just want to discuss it a little bit, and then we'll take action on it. So, Representative Fabian to 533, and then a little bit on the amendment as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. House Bill 533 deals with a very specific issue that has occurred up in Lancaster, Minnesota. Lancaster is an example of a school that does a great job of educating their students with limited resources. They are a very, very small school district in a very, very sparsely populated area. And the essence of the bill is to return to them their sparsity aid that they lost when the elementary school in Kennedy was closed and those students moved to Hallock. And what this bill is attempting to do is to restore that funding so that their budget is not so seriously impacted by that loss of sparsity aid. In the process of doing this bill, it was also brought to my attention that the Northland Community School was also a school district that was affected quite adversely by the loss of sparsity revenue. So I do have a author's amendment, a friendly amendment, the A11 amendment that deals with the Northland Community School, and I would ask that you approve that as well.
Representative Fabian, what we'll do is at the appropriate time, we're going to take the bill and the amendment. We do not have copies of the amendment now, but if we could maybe take some testimony, and then we'll formally move the bill as well as the amendment.
Yep. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Brad Homestead. He is the superintendent of schools in Lancaster, and he really can answer your questions after a short presentation.
Hi. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Brad Homestead. I'm the superintendent at Lancaster Public School. And I'd like to just give you kind of an overview of what our school district is like. It's not your average rural Minnesota school. I think it's great in every sense of the word. Our graduation rate exceeds 95%. Our attendance rate exceeds 96%. We've received numerous state and national awards and recognition. Not only did we make AYP, but schooldigger.com, it's a national web-based program that is used by parents to compare schools based on test scores. We were rated the number one school in the state of Minnesota. We received the Minnesota Senate Award for Excellence Education. We received the Governor's Fit School Award. And we were notified by U.S. News and World Report that we're identified as being one of the very best high schools in the United States. And criteria that they used for these different awards included district curriculum, college readiness of graduates, and MCA test results for all special populations. Our local taxpayers have already dug deep. Currently, we have two referendums on the books. They total $2,700 per pupil unit, and I believe that's the second highest in the entire state. In addition, 53% of our families are eligible for free or reduced meals. And to be honest, I just don't know if our taxpayers can dig any deeper. We do live in a very sparsely populated area of the state. We have less than 5 people per square mile. Our enrollment area is 456 square miles, but actually with the open enrollment, we actually have more. It's closer to 1,000 square miles that we have to bus daily. Each day my buses travel over 500 miles. If our school did not exist, and this is really a sparsely populated area, the students on my eastern boundary would have to ride a bus 3 hours per day to get to and from school, and that to me is just totally unacceptable. These kids don't have anywhere else to go. I did talk with Tom Melcher, Director of Program Finance at the Department of Education, and just asked him if there had been any similar situations where the actions of one school district would have such a tremendously negative financial impact on another school district. And he replied back to me after talking to his staff that neither he or anyone on his staff could ever recall a situation similar to ours. This really is a huge part of our budget. We are a high-quality school. We've already cut to the bone. We actually have, our taxpayers have dug deep. We aren't asking for any new dollars, but we're just asking you to keep our current funding in place. This is a unique situation, but it has devastating consequences for my school district, so I'm asking you to please hold us harmless. I'd like to thank you for allowing us here today. Thank you for your consideration of House File 533, and if it pleases the chair at this time, Board Member Hansen has a few prepared statements to make as well.
Sure. Before we do that, Representative Fabian moves House File 533 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And then Representative Fabian, the A110122 amendment, I believe this is the amendment that you briefly described earlier. Is that correct?
Yes.
And Representative Greiling, my apologies. We did not have copies of this in the packet. It did meet the 24-hour deadline, but I just wanted to make sure it was okay. We move forward on this.
Mr. Chair.
Hold on. Is that okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did, however, know about it. Ms. Patrick know about it, so we are prepared, so it's okay.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I apologize for not having the amendment in a timely manner. So, thank you.
Is there any discussion for regarding the A110122 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Please continue with your testimony. And welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. George Hansen, Director at Lancaster School. I'll be pretty short here. I'm just trying to put a little context to what Superintendent Homestead said. We've mentioned that the local operating levy is very high for our school, $2,676 per pupil unit. But I think the better context to put that in is as a percentage of referendum market value. I was in contact with Bob Porter over at the MED. And Lancaster has the 6th smallest referendum market value in the state of Minnesota at $23.7 million. But we have the 2nd highest operating referendum as a percentage of market value. And I just want to emphasize that, going to what Mr. Homestead has said in terms of digging deep. The community has dug deep. We've obviously, in terms of what is available for us for taxation on the local level, we've utilized that. And I hope you folks would all take that into account. The other thing I just wanted to mention, I seen that the chair introduced a House File 1093, which is the old 70% rule that Governor Plenty introduced back in 2006. And at that time, Lancaster was one of the 54 outstate schools that met that criteria. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Fabian, or to our testifiers, because some of the members weren't here, can you briefly describe the history of why this has been corrected in the past? We've made the case for why it needs to be corrected going forward, but in the past, explain what events took place to require this change on the state's perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what's happened is the Lancaster School District borders the Hallock School District, which is to the west. To the south of the Hallock School District is the Kennedy School District. And as I understand it, Hallock, Kennedy combined, and the high school in Hallock remained there, but the high school in Kennedy was closed. They maintained their elementary school. At some point they decided to close the elementary school in Kennedy and then move those students to the Hallock building. As a result of that move, the number of miles that exist between the elementary school in Kennedy, which was closed, and the Lancaster school changed, because those miles now are counted between Hallock and Lancaster. And I apologize if you're being confused by this, because there's different communities involved, but that's the essence of what happened. So as a result of that shortening of the miles that existed between the two school districts, they would then lose their sparsity revenue. And that's why we are here then asking for this appropriation to be made. This is also a bill, this is a situation that has been funded for the past 4 years, I believe, by the legislature, and we're just asking that these funds continue.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Haven. And Representative Purcell, did you wish to discuss the Northland Community School closing section of the bill, or did you prefer that we have House staff run through it, whatever your preference is?
I would, Mr. Chair, and members, what I'd like to do, if I may, is just briefly describe, but then I have the superintendent of the Northland Community Schools is here as well to discuss that specifically.
That'd be great, Representative.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a very similar situation. The Reamer Longville School District 118 had to close a school and left with a hole in their budget, and so that's why we're trying to hopefully save a little time and paper and everything, and combining these together here. So, if I may, Mr. Chair, bring down the superintendent here.
Hello, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, so that 100 years from now we know who you are.
My name's Ron Bradley.
Maybe not.
I'm superintendent at Northland Community Schools. I'm the third superintendent in 4 months, so I haven't done all the research that the previous superintendent has made. But I will tell you that Northland Community Schools covers 840 square miles. We have about 385 students, a very similar type situation. And he also bragged, and I'm going to brag and say that our elementary school is a blue ribbon school. So. And we have 70% free and reduced lunch, so we're in competition here a little bit. Let me give you a brief history of what's happened here. Northland Community Schools, as a result of a forced consolidation several years ago, where Longville lost their high school because of enrollment, and so Northland Community Schools then was combined with an elementary in Longville and a elementary and secondary in Reamer. The district has been receiving elementary sparsity aid, and I've gone back to 94, since at least 1994. In the spring of 2010, with an enrollment in the K-4 at Longville of about 60 students, superintendent at that time recommended that Longville Elementary be closed because of lack of students and also because of budget concerns. This was very emotionally charged, and a divided school board and a long-standing hard feelings, quite honestly, from Longville. There was a lot of pressure on the school board about keeping the school open, and a board member resigned. It's a seven-member board, so now we have three from Longville, three from Reamer, and there was tie votes as far as the issue of closing the school, and also for tie votes as far as replacing that seventh board member. After much debate and some time had lapsed, we finally yielded to appoint a seventh board member, and on May 15th, the board voted to close the Longville Elementary. On May 20th, the superintendent at that time wrote a letter to the commissioner, as is required by Minnesota Statute 126 C10 Subdivision 8, which you're familiar with, and stated that the Longville School was closed and would like to continue getting the elementary sparsity aid as required by statute. The commissioner denied the continuance because of the date, because the statute requires notice 60 days before the beginning of the next fiscal year. And so it was actually 20 days after the fact. I personally appealed that decision in December after I took the position, and the commissioner also denied it and referred me to seek a legislative action. And that's why I'm here. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And members of the committee, or first of all, Representative Fabian and Representative Purcell, do you have any additional testifiers or comments before we take members or questions for members?
Mr. Chair, no, I do not.
Okay. This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify for or voice concerns about the bill? I see none. We'll close the public portion of our meeting and take questions from members. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always appreciate having been just a few times myself up to the northwest corner of the state when people drive all the way down here. I know it's quite a trek, and so it's very nice to see so many people here and that you've come. I remember this bill very well from when we passed it in 2008. Was it you, Superintendent, or was it a board member that actually came to my living room to pitch this bill? It was you. Okay, yes. That very earnest people who wanted this bill. And my question, I'm trying to remember, I was thinking it was a time-limited bill, or was this passed into perpetuity? At Mr. Strom, if I could ask him.
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, a couple of different issues here. The provision that creates the sparsity for closed facilities was a provision that was adopted at about the same time that the 4 years of funding for Lancaster were decided, and that was done as a special law for 4 years. So the Lancaster situation was temporarily addressed with four annual appropriations of the amount of the sparsity revenue lost. The provision in front of you, Subdivision 8A, sparsity revenue for school districts that close facilities, was a bill that Representative Sertich brought to the Education Committee. And a couple of things about that. You'll see in Representative Fabian's bill on lines 10 and 11, the bill amends that language to make clear that the sparsity adjustment should occur whether or not it was the resident district or another district that closed the facility. And then secondly, the point that the superintendent just mentioned on lines 1.17, the 60 days there has tripped up more than one district over the last 3 or 4 years. When Representative Sertich created this provision, his thinking was that some time was necessary in order for the school closure issue to be properly addressed by a school board so that it wasn't sprung at the last minute. But I think you heard from the superintendent today that 60 days may be too long of a time period in many cases if boards are making these decisions at their May meetings. So I'm not sure if that quite answers your question or not, but the Lancaster situation was addressed with four separate appropriations, and now this would make that permanent.
Representative Greiling.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that was my question, and that was the answer that I was thinking. And that's why now I have to honestly say that I'm concerned about this bill, because when we passed it for Lancaster, and it seems to me that now this year Northland fits into that category, it was because of a recent situation, and we were wanting to have a soft hill instead of a big cliff for the funding that that the school districts had been getting, and then through no fault of their own, that they would not get. And I like this bill, Representative Fabian, in the sense that it's, you know, doesn't just get the top part of it anyway, is all districts, not just your district, you know, but yet we have two districts named here, and then we have this chart in our packet about miles to the next secondary school. And so my question then again for Representative Fabian, and then I have one for Mr. Strom, how far now, and I would ask the same of Representative Purcells or your representatives, how far now are your schools apart? If not the 19 miles anymore, so what is the number?
To the testifiers, Representative Fabian, Representative Purcell, or whoever wants to answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Greiling, I'll refer the question to Superintendent Homestead.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, at the current time is 12.4 miles between my building and the next closest building. So it had been 22. It's reduced down to 12.4.
Representative Greiling.
And then Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, or his superintendent from Northland.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Longville Elementary is 20 miles from the Reamer School. The closest building from another district would be probably, I don't know my mileage that well, but probably 19 to, would be at least 20 miles to another district, I would guess, to another elementary.
And I'm hesitant to ask this question, but is that as the crow flies, or is that by...
That's at the crow's flies, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
That's why, there's a lot of lakes, and there are very few straight roads.
Yep, okay. Representative Greiling.
Mr. Chair, then I'm perplexed why Northland even needs it if the distance is 19 miles and they're still 19 miles or more.
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, there's two parts to the elementary sparsity formula. One is the miles to the next nearest elementary, which is 19 miles, and the other is that the elementary school can't serve more than 22 pupils per grade. And so in the situation in the Reamers, in the Northland Community Schools case, my guess is that it's still more than 19 miles to the next nearest elementary, but that now that the two elementary school sites are combined, that their population is over 20 per grade. And so even if it were 40 miles to the next nearest elementary, once you're over 20 pupils per grade, there's no elementary sparsity for the district.
Okay. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, so that answers that question. But my concern that, I'm always looking for whatever we change in the formula. I really don't like it when we change it for one district or another when there's others who qualify for the same thing. I did not like it when we put in compensatory revenue just for some districts when others qualified. And so whatever it is we decide to spend our money on, I'm always try to be very strict and persistent about threshold bills so everybody who qualifies for the same thing doesn't have to come the next year and say, what about me? And now I'm looking here, I'm assuming all these districts, never mind about the 20 pupils per grade. There's several districts on the list that have less than 19 miles on the miles to the next school. So my question is, are there other districts or are there likely to be other districts that that would qualify that aren't going to get in with their name in this bill, or is this general language on 1.10 and 1.11 going to cover them?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling. I think the general language on lines 10 and 11, along with the existing subdivision, should cover everybody from here on out, so long as the districts aren't tripped up by the deadline. And as I mentioned before, I think that 60 days may continue to be problematic. That was problematic in the year after Representative Sertich's bill passed. It tripped up another district that year, and then it's tripped up Northland this past year as well. So from my perspective, I'd urge you to consider the 60 days as something that could create the need for special legislation in the future. The second point I'd like to make is the printout shows the sparsity amounts for elementary and secondary, and remember that those are calculated separately. The elementary sparsity is just two components, 19 miles or more to the next nearest building and 20 or fewer pupils per grade at the elementary grades. And that's all there is to the elementary formula. The secondary formula is quite a bit more complicated. The secondary sparsity formula depends not only on the miles to the next nearest school, but it also depends on a measure of the square mile area of the district. And it actually, to use that measure for reasons that are geometrically clear but not otherwise, it uses the square root of 55% of the square mile areas of the district as a length measure. And really what that does is draws a line from the center of the district to the edge of the district. So the idea is you're getting a measurement from the furthest edge of the district to the center of the district and then off to the next nearest secondary school. And then the size limit for the secondary schools is quite a bit larger. The size limit for secondary schools is 400 students at the secondary site. So elementary and sparsity revenue are calculated differently. There's also one other thing I should add. It's calculated on a site level. So, for example, if you're looking at the districts on Lancaster's page, another district up that way is if you look up at 318 Grand Rapids, for example, you can see they're quite a large district, but they have a small school that's isolated, and so the sparsity is calculated on the basis of the school sites, not on the basis of the district characteristics.
And Representative Grantley, just while we're on this point, if I could just, so Mr. Sure. Strom, my understanding was is that Section 3, absent the 60-day requirement, would the statutes would, if a similar situation happened to Northland Community School at another school district, Section 1 of the bill would cover them. The Section 3 of the bill is pertaining to just the 60-day requirement. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Garland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my last question then is, so I seem to be being satisfied that Representative Fabian has a bill that's fair to others. But then the fiscal note only applies to Lancaster. And I understand that if we add in Northland, that's another $100,000 a year. And I'm wondering, are there any others right now that would also qualify? And if so, what would be the fiscal note? And then is this an open and standing appropriation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, in reverse order, yes, it's part of general education, so it's open and standing. You're correct that the combined fiscal note would be $200,000 per year. Coincidentally, it's $100,000 at each of these sites per year. In terms of future district behavior, I'm not sure that this change would cause any difference in district behavior. It may be that some school districts will close schools in the future. Well, the current law already covers a situation where the district closes its own facility. The current law does not cover the situation that Lancaster found themselves in. And I'm not aware of any school closures that would have that effect in the next year or two, but those are district-based decisions about which schools they might close, and usually their considerations don't revolve around how that would affect sparsity for the neighboring district.
Representative Grantley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this will be my last question. And so you're pretty sure then that this is a $200,000 a year bill and it doesn't open the door for a lot more closures, and then it would cost a lot more than we expected. Because, members, you know, this is a spending bill. We're looking at a 10 point, it's a small amount of money, but we're looking at a $10.2 billion cut. So if we raise money in some area, we have to cut it in others.
Did you say $10.2 billion?
Oh my gosh, a Freudian slip. $10.2 million. I always like to think of it as a big number, but you know, it's only a
just keep digging, Representative Greiling.
I'm down there. But I, you know, I always, whenever we're talking small numbers and small districts, we are a much more generous committee. And since I have middle-sized districts and we have large districts, then when we get around to Anoka Hennepin's, if you know they would want anything appropriating this on a you know percentage scale or something, they'd be less apt to get it because they're a big district. So you know that always plays in the favor of small districts. But I just wanted. So I'm wondering. How long do you think? Do you think this is a pretty static number that this really doesn't affect many districts? And that's my last question.
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, I think in large part it depends what small districts in Minnesota are going to do next. There was a large round of school district consolidations in the 1990s. Schools like the Kitson Central School District consolidated during that time period. That round of school consolidations led many of those districts for a number of reasons not to close many buildings, but instead, as they consolidated, to keep one building for secondary and the other for elementary. There were certain efficiencies associated with that. Many of these smallest districts are now finding that they're going to need to close a school facility. The current law covers that situation when it's within that facility's change that causes the effect. So really the question becomes, what's our guess as to the number of those effects that will a number of those changes that will affect other districts. And in general, my guess is that they'll be very small, because it's likely when two small rural districts that have already consolidated are looking at moving a facility, it's going to be unlike the Kennedy situation where it moves closer, and instead it's going to move further apart. So I'm guessing that there's going to be very little effect from the new permanent language on lines 110 and 111.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you.
And Representative Greiling was kind of right on one point, and that is that this committee has to decide how we are going to appropriate the 3.4% increase in education funding that we're getting compared to the last session. So this will be one of the items that's put into the request of how we're going to appropriate that increase in spending that we're committing to education. Representative Fabian, Representative Pizzella are testifying. First of all, is there any other questions? Representative Anzels.
Well, of course, I support the bill, and but it is with the knowledge that whether it's site consolidation or district consolidation or sharing and cooperative arrangements between districts, that's the fact of life. That's the future in Greater Minnesota. And this committee and this legislature should approach this topic with eyes wide open and minds very, very clear. On the one hand, we should be incentivizing districts to make these decisions for efficiency purposes and all of the other things that school boards have to deal with. And this member knows firsthand what closing sites and merging districts can do to communities and businesses and kids and parents. But keep your eyes wide open. This is going to cost money. And we ought to be appropriating the dollars to accomplish this. And some of us are going to vote for those dollars, and some of us are not. So look into your heart, rural members, when you approach this topic and others with in the remaining weeks of the session. This is going to cost money.
Representative Anzels, does that mean you're going to be voting for the education omnibus bill?
No comment.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Loon, and then next is Representative Greiling. Representative Loon.
Thank you, and to our superintendents or whoever wants to answer this. And I apologize if you said it early on. I walked in about 5 minutes late, but just what is the current student enrollment that you have at your schools? And, you know, projecting out, you know, as far as you're able to, do you feel that that number is going to remain pretty stable?
So either the superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our enrollment at Lancaster in our total school is about 168 kids. We have about, I believe it's 85 in our elementary. We've done the long-range projections, and actually we're finally at a point where the number of kids coming into kindergarten is equal to the number of kids that are graduating each year. So we're projecting basically a very stable enrollment for as far out into the future as we can go at this time.
Representative Loon, or the other superintendent, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have approximately 385 students, K-12, and I've looked out 5 years, and the enrollment will continue to decline, not substantially, but it will continue to decline as it appears now. There is one factor that we do not have any control on, but we have seen some enrollment coming from the reservation school and coming to our school, and that affects our student population quite a bit. I just wanted to also mention that when we closed the Longville school, it was a K-4. There were 63 students in that building, and as a result of closing that building, we lost 60 students to a different district. That's how emotional it was, and that had an effect. And since we were receiving approximately $100,000 in elementary sparsity for several years, and the loss of that, not only this year but next year and every year, it's going to adversely affect the district. I'm making recommendations to the board on Thursday night to reduce the budget by $400,000, which is substantial, losing 10% of our staff, and it's going to be difficult. The $100,000, of course, is not going to save us, but it certainly will help maintain some teachers in the classroom.
Thank you. Representative Lynn.
Thank you. And I grew up in a very rural area of South Dakota, a small school. I had 100 kids in my total high school. And I don't know if you added the elementary and the high school together. I don't know if we had 200 kids in the district, maybe. So I'm familiar with kind of the struggles in that. Are you consolidating any of your school activities in that with other school districts right now? I know that sometimes that happens and maybe is the precursor of other things happening. So I'm just trying to get a fuller picture of what's going on in your schools.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the high school, what we're working on very diligently right now is putting together it's a hybrid ITV system that we will utilize in the high school among the Itasca area school districts, and that is going to be a very important instrument in providing education for our students. Because of the distance and because of the poverty level in our district, the school building is really the only safe haven they have, and it is only the only opportunity not only for students to get an education but also for the community to get education. And so we are looking at all options, and that is going to be an option that will help provide and sustain a good education for our students.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just to elaborate on that a little bit in Lancaster, since the time that we lost the sparsity aid when the Kitson Central closing, every year since that time we've had a community organization council sort of, including 3 board members, 10 members from the community, where we've been implementing budget cuts, trying to find saving opportunities or cooperation with other districts to save money. We're basically at the point where we've implemented those. Superintendent Homestead and our business manager have done an outstanding job at cutting costs. We're to the point in our district where we're looking at either a 4-day school day, which has not been popular in the community, and then after that looking at blended classrooms in the elementary school. As I said before, we're the second highest operating referendum by market value in the state. The community has shown an intense interest in keeping the school open. If the Kennedy School, when it shut down, destroyed that community, to be blunt. Nobody in Lancaster is interested in that. So we're into survival mode, per se. The community has stood up and said, we want our school, and we're just trying to mitigate the tax burden that they're faced with by doing that.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you.
I continue to be amazed by the diversity of experiences that communities have across the state, and that's important, particularly for members from the metro area, to understand that a school closing in a metro or suburban area is a radically different experience than a school closing in a rural area. It is a much, much different experience. Representative Greiland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will say, even though I agree it's a much, much different thing, it's a very difficult thing no matter where it happens. I represent a community of Lauderdale that lost their school before the chair was born, and they're still bitterly, bitterly, bitterly mad about it. But anyway, I just wanted to provide accurate information. We kind of smile, and the chair has one interpretation, and I have another. But I have Bill Marks, who's our nonpartisan House fiscal staff, to back up my information. So I want to not call it my information, but his. And I just know that there's some people in this room that don't regularly attend our hearing, so I feel we need to have the accurate information. And that is, this is from the Ways and Means Committee yesterday, I think. And I lose track of time, but the schools have been cut this year, according to the nonpartisan fiscal staff, by $11.252 million, which is a 0.1 cut. So we all agree, you know, it's not a huge cut, but we need to have accurate information. It is a cut because you have to go base year to base year, not biennium to not biennium. So that stimulus money that, you know, supplanted other money never was taken out of the base. So the accurate nonpartisan information is an $11.2 million cut. So I just will always have to put in that accurate information unless we're talking amongst ourselves when we can have our own set of facts, Chair Grafflo.
And Representative Greiling, since we're having this conversation, that take that spreadsheet back out and look at it. If you look at that spreadsheet, what is the increase from last biennium to this biennium? What percentage increase? Representative
Grafflo. Mr. Chair, that isn't the point. The point is when you have when we want to have accurate information, we go base funding to base funding. And when you want to skew the information, and Mr. Chair, the reason I know this is because my caucus has done this too. You know, you can factor in how many new students there are. You can go biennium to biennium. You can count year to year. But you can jiggle statistics or the Bible however you wish to prove your own point. But you, in order to have consistent year to year, so the school districts and the public can know what are we doing and trust it to be true, then around here you always go to the nonpartisan fiscal staff and you go base year to base year. So if you want to play games with it, and I can see you smiling over there, Mr. Chair, you can, but I'm dead serious here that I think we have to be fairly honest. And then it's an $11.2 million cut. We've always factored in paying for new students and paying for them, whether they're compensatory, special ed, don't speak English. We always factor that in. And I heard some toying. We worried for the first time your caucus wasn't going to do that, and we were ready to pounce. Thankfully, you got hold of yourselves and your better selves and didn't do that. But now, to have to be playing this game and trying to manipulate the figures just so you can say you increase funding, I'll have to say, you know, in the Ways and Means Committee, where the people there are the pretty much the fiscal chairs and people like respected fiscal minds of the legislature, like Representative Lyndon Carlson, Representative Mary Liz Holberg, there was not this silly discussion in the Ways and Means Committee. We plain, everybody got it, everybody understood, and we moved on. It's only in this committee where we have a lot of new members that Representative Grafflo is trying to play this game. But I want to make sure that we get just as educated about base-to-base funding as the Ways and Means Committee, because it's the accurate information. We should not be political and pretend that we gave more money to schools than we did when the superintendents here who have driven all the way from northwestern Minnesota, I don't think they want to go for levy referendums or school board members and have us legislators crowing that we increased money to education when you actually got a small, but still a small, and more importantly, no increase funding to your base budgets, which are the ones I think you probably have to operate with as well, the ones we give you from us.
Well, I think you guys just love being at the Education Finance Committee, don't you? So I think Representative Greiling and I will continue to have this conversation going forward. And certainly I want to make very, very clear. And when the omnibus bill is revealed at some point later this week or next week, there will be no reductions whatsoever in the public or charter schools of the state of Minnesota. And I can say that because I know what the bill is going to be. That $11 million that you're talking about is not taking into account the capital loan refinancing. It's not taking into account agency budget reductions. No. So I can say that. So you can, and Representative Greiling, we can go back and forth on these numbers. But the reality is the argument you are making is that a larger number is a cut. And when you guys were in charge and it was a smaller number, it wasn't a cut. I understand it. It's education finance. We can argue both sides of it. The same spreadsheet you're looking at shows an increase in the state's commitment to education of over $800 million. Even if you remove the federal stimulus, the numbers are still higher. When you were in charge of this committee, the numbers went down. So we can argue this back and forth, and I suspect I'm never going to change your mind, and you're not going to change my mind. But we can continue this conversation as soon as we wrap up this bill and before we take up the next one. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, no.
I guess not. Representative Greiling.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not fair because you're not giving the nonpartisan information, which is the accurate information around here. You're giving your own spin on it. It's not accurate. It's partisan interpretation. It's ludicrous. And I just beg you to not keep repeating it, because I think it makes it very hard for our school districts to pass levy referendums if the public thinks they got almost $1 billion more dollars in this biennium than they got the year before. Why would any taxpayer want to renew a levy referendum? Why wouldn't they ask the superintendent and the school boards, what are you doing with all that money? You know, you got another extra $1 billion practically out of the legislature. They may have been cutting everything else, but they gave an extra $1 billion to education, and that's just inaccurate. So it's not fair, Mr. Chair, for you to keep saying that. You should stick with the nonpartisan facts, not your own spin. You can do what you want out in the world when you're campaigning or being political, but sitting here in this chair, and especially sitting in the chair's chair, I think you should be honest and accurate.
Well, Representative Greiling, the sheet that you're showing, it's nonpartisan research, shows the over 3% increase from the last biennium to this one. We will have a disagreement on perspective, and we'll let this bill finish up, but I am proud of the target that the majority caucus has put together. I am proud of the majority members of this committee for fighting for education and making it a priority. It is clear that the amount of money we're going to spend on education this year is not going to be as the debate is. That target level is 99.8% of what Governor Dayton's budget recommendation is. The disagreements and the conversations are going to be about where we spend it, how we spend it, and what reforms will be enacted on that. But again, the amount of money we're spending on education, it's just not, that's just not where the debate is. But Representative Greiling, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, if you would state it that way, then I wouldn't have to argue with you at all, because you're now, I think, coming around to the accurate information, that the real statement that we could agree on is $11.2 million is not a very big cut, and why you can't just stick with that, be proud of that, all the members around this table that did what our members did last time. We fought it up to a zero. You still have an $11.2 million cut, but it's almost the same difference. But this nonsense about hundreds of millions of dollars more than what the Democrats had is nothing but nonsense.
All right. Well, we'll come back to this conversation numerous times in the next couple of weeks. Did Representative Fabian or Representative Purcell, if he's still here, any of the closing comments from the testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you alluded to what I was going to say here, and I look forward very much to the next bill that I'm a part of in this committee. And you have very interesting conversations. I'd appreciate your support. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any other closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that this is continuance. It's not new money. It's continuance of money that we've received since at least 1994. All right. Thank you.
And thank you very much to all our testifiers, especially for the long drive down. I went to Representative Fabian, and I said, why don't we have them Skype in or video in? He said, no, they want to come down. They want to stare into your eyeballs and tell you how important this is. So I hope that you found the trip down today worthwhile, and we really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to make the trip down.
Thank you.
And with that, Representative Fabian renews his motion to have House File 553 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney and Anzels, and then we'll move on to 1040. Representative Dabney.
Thank you. You just stated that there would be no cuts to traditional public or charter schools in the bill when you unveil it later this week, early next, whatever your timeline is. Does that mean that you have a commitment to stable and secure funding, and school districts can expect to get what they are getting today?
Representative Dabney, no. At an each individual school district will have thousands of different variables at play, but the state's commitment to education overall, when you aggregate those numbers and you consolidate them into one number, I can make that commitment to you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Can they expect 99.8% of what they're getting today?
On a statewide basis, they can actually expect over 99.8%, but individual school districts, based on many variables, no. Each district, there's hundreds of school districts, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I'm familiar with the number of school districts. Will the majority's approach be Robin Hood and taking from the poor and giving to the rich, or reverse Robin Hood and taking from the poor?
Representative Dabney, as I've mentioned elsewhere previous times, The aid program that our state has been studied exhaustively, is ridiculously complicated, and we're going to be taking a look at all areas of education and funding those things that we believe are work, and reprioritizing and repurposing dollars that are not working. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, we've asked repeatedly what the metrics you will be using are in your decision-making, and you've consistently declined to answer the question. Will you let us know today, tomorrow, Friday?
Representative,
I think I missed a day in there, but
Representative,
you get the point.
Representative Dabney, I have answered your question. I haven't answered it to your satisfaction, but the important thing is that later this week, early next week, we'll have a document where we can have that conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually thought that that conversation on the bill was productive and useful and necessary, but it should be continued because I have a suspicion that when one looks at the districts and the sites and superintendents and boards in the L of Minnesota, the L together with the Iron Range, with declining enrollments and declining dollars and declining curriculum rigor, we have a lot of school districts in greater Minnesota that are hemorrhaging. And whether or not we can have conversations around this table about finances and $11 million or whatever numbers we want to banter about, I think this conversation with school superintendents in greater Minnesota dealing with declining enrollment should be something that we really ought to have. We really ought to have that kind of conversation because I think many of you who represent metro, urban, and suburban districts would be appalled to listen to rural school superintendents describe for you the gyrations they go through just to keep kids in their districts, just to keep parents, just to keep curriculum rigor. So I thought this was a good conversation.
Yeah, I agree, Representative Anzels, and I think, you know, it's a lot of the purview out of this committee, but you know, one of the best ways to keep students and to grow student populations in rural areas is for jobs to be out there and for job creation in a dynamic economy. And I know that you fight just as hard as the rest of the Iron Range delegation to make sure that especially those mining jobs are being retained but also grown up on the range. And I know it's a conversation outside the purview of this committee, but it's important that members know that if there's no jobs, the families leave. And so you got to have jobs. You got to. So thank you. And Representative Anzels, I think it's a good conversation as well. So Representative Bills moves House File 1040 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Bills, do you have any amendments to your bill?
No, I do not, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bills, to your bill.
Thank you,
Mr.
We just
got to change your last name or something. We just got to Representative Hurt or something.
Kind of fun, though. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The proposal you have before you today amends lease levy authority to ensure that the optimization of learning fostered by TIES can continue. If you don't know what TIES is, I have a couple of gentlemen here today who are going to discuss that, and the details of the proposal can be found in your packet. As a teacher, though, who uses the technology and informational services supplied by TIES each and every school day, I know how important this proposal is not only to my district, 196, but also the other 41 school districts that benefit from their services. And with that, I'd rather have these two gentlemen have more time to discuss. So I'll turn this over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair, Mr. William Griffith and Greg Baufield, I believe. Thank
Welcome
you.
To the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Greg Baufield, I'm the Director of Business Development for TIES.
And I'm Bill Griffith, representing TIES.
Please proceed with your testimony.
A little background on who TIES is. TIES was created out of a study that came out of the university in the late 60s and provides essential technology services for our member districts, 41 districts. We've actually been adding districts. We're growing. Over the last couple of years, we've added one district a year. Last week, we found out that we have five new districts joining TIES, and they're members, the districts that are up along the St. Croix Valley, north and east of the Twin Cities. So we've been around for quite some number of years, and now growing over the last few years as well. We We provide core applications for student accounting, grade taking, so on, as well as finance, HR, payroll applications. All of them are integrated. In addition to that, we have the teaching services. If you're a teacher and you've got a new smart board and you want to know how to use that smart board, likely you would come to TIES to get those core instruction. And we also have technical services. If you're a district with limited resources trying to install a new wireless network or new connectivity or firewalls, you would call on TIES professional services. So basically, that's who TIES is today. We're looking for some help on our facility. Our facility is located at the intersection of Larpenteur and Snelling, purchased some number of years ago. If you've ever been to the state fairgrounds, you're familiar with our location.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And I think every member of the committee is familiar with your spot, because when we volunteer at the state fair, that's where we park. So welcome to the committee.
Please continue parking there.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Bill Griffith. I'm representing TIES today, and we'll briefly cover what's in the bill and the proposed amendment. The building is a landmark building, and when TIES purchased the building, the member districts obviously become the owner. Over 40 school districts, member districts, actually own that building, and they're proud of the building. It's a landmark, but because it's a landmark, it's old. And there's deferred maintenance at the time of the purchase. There was a lease levy put in place by the legislature to allow the purchase of that building, and now that that building has essentially been paid for as of last month, now the deferred maintenance comes due, and it's really important that, that TIES be able to undertake that with its members. A couple of things about the bill. Last year, this amendment, this very modest amendment, was included in the omnibus bill on the Senate side and was passed unanimously. You of course know what happened to that bill late in the session, or I guess in the special session, and so obviously we're back looking for what we consider a pretty modest amendment. What it does for the members is it allows this this lease levy to continue, and it actually will be a reduction in the total amount, in part because of what Mr. Baufield said. We're adding member districts, so as you spread the total number, 632,000 a year, over more districts, you obviously decrease the amount of the lease levy. The other thing that is noteworthy is we've looked carefully at the projects. Our client has looked carefully at the projects that are necessary and has actually reduced the number of capital projects. And so there, as compared to the last 10 years, there will be a reduction in the amount for each member district. With that, I guess a couple of noteworthy items is all the member districts support this approach, this lease levy approach to financing the capital improvements, and the total building value has increased from $4.3 million when it was purchased in 2000 and is now valued at $13 million. And so obviously, just like our homes and our workplaces, it's important to keep up those buildings and keep up that value to the member district. I won't give you the long stories about the monsoon rains coming in through the roof last summer. The HVAC system, there is actually air conditioning, is older than most of the people, I think probably all the people in this room. So suffice to say, it's definitely necessary, and it has been deferred about as long as it can be. This is a device. Lease levy for capital improvements is something that school districts use routinely, and we'd like to be able to just continue that lease levy at a lower amount for the next 10 years to accomplish those ends. So thank you for your time today, and we're open to questions.
Representative Bills, do you have any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, no, I do not.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify for or voice concerns about the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public portion of our testimony, and we'll move to members' questions. Before we do that, Mr. Straub, Mr. Crow, can you please just briefly explain to members the impact on levy and not impact on levy?
Mr. Chair and members, as part of your budget process, you keep track of overall state levies as well as state aid payments with a levy tracking sheet. Any bill that increases the ability of districts or a district or a group of districts or all districts to levy is tracked as additional levy on that tracking sheet. and comes into play depending on your committee's target for statewide levies. So a bill like this that authorizes an additional $632,000 per year on the levy tracking sheet will show an added $632,000 on the lease levy tracking line on that spreadsheet. In the past, there's been a zero levy target, so other levies would have had to have been reduced by $632,000 to keep statewide levies overall at no growth.
Thank you, Representative Plum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like what I'm hearing. I'm just curious, what do the nearly 300 other school districts do since they're not Potter ties?
To either of the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are other cooperatives around the state. There are other regional cooperatives where they use the smart finance system. There's a cooperative out of Mankato, Marshall, St. Cloud, Moorhead, and Duluth where they would bind together. And so many of your greater Minnesota school districts will use that cooperative arrangement for their finance systems. There are other service cooperatives around the state where they band together for other shared services for internet connectivity, training, some of the other things that I mentioned, the core service of the ties. That help?
Representative Plum, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, any school district, whether they're a member or not, can purchase services through ties as well.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe my question has been answered, but I thought the gentleman suggested that this would be a lesser amount in regard to our levy, and so I thought it would be a property decrease. But after listening to Mr. Crow, I guess I'm wrong. So, Mr. Crow, could you straighten me out on that?
No, you're right, but I think okay. I know the answer, but we'll let staff figure this out. Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe they were talking about the... if you think about more of a rate impact, talking about spreading it across an additional number of districts. You see in your packet there's a spreadsheet that's got the potential impact of the $632,000. They would still be levying the $632,000, just might be spread it on a different number of districts if they have additional members they're going to apply it to.
Representative Erickson.
And Mr. Chair, we have to account for that. We have to account for that. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I'm just trying to get a little more familiar with this. I know my district is a district that participates in ties and that. I've been to your building, but that's the extent of my understanding right now. So currently, are those member districts for the purchase of the building did through their levy authority provide funds for that? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. There was an original procurement of the building. The building is now paid in full as of last month, I think it was. So we're simply asking to go back to that form so that we can fix some pretty serious problems for the building.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for those districts with the levy, is this combined with other levies that they may have for facilities, or is it a separate levy?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe this comes out as a separate line item under other, other districts, essentially on the tax bill. But it is a levy, much like other school district levies. But it does show as a separate line item. And to clarify, what we were when we said there was a decrease, it's in comparison to the last 10 years in which they were paying for the building.
So for members' purposes, and Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, I just want to make sure I have this right, so I don't want to screw the committee up, but what's happened is that we're assuming the levy is gone for assumption purposes, so this is lower than it has been in the past, but it is above what is projected if we make no changes.
Right.
Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, compared to base, which now assumes no levy for these purposes, it would be an additional $632,000.
Correct.
And that's what we measure when we track the levies.
And for the testifiers, they're saying it's less, but they're basing it off of what was previously levied.
Correct. The districts had 10 years of experience paying about the same amount, and that was paid off in February. And so from that standpoint, they will experience a smaller payment for the TIES building.
It's education finance. Nothing is easy. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's helpful. And these levies are not required to have a referendum. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just reading through your description and mentioning that the TIES Executive Board authorized a purchase in that. Are the participating school districts members of that board, or who comprises that board?
To the testifiers.
Board Chair, Representative Loon. Yes. Our largest member district at this time is Hennepin County, or the Anoka Schools District, excuse me. And the smallest is Randolph Schools with, I think, 550 or something like that. There is a relationship between this different size of the districts, and then representatives are selected to serve on the executive board of TIES. And those representatives out of those grouping members of size of districts are either superintendents or school board members themselves that make up that executive committee. Does that answer your question?
Representative Loon.
Thank you. Yes. And I'm sorry, I just have a lot of questions. When a participating school district comes for either teacher training on technology or something, is there a charge to the school district for that if they are, again, providing levy support for the purchase of the building? Or what's the additional financial requirement on school districts or participate in your programs?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, and other members of the committee, membership has its privileges. There is a membership function. And with that membership function, there is certain fees associated also with a teaching and learning. So there's an assessment made on a pro rata basis to the districts for that teaching and learning component. So districts can be a member. They can also opt in on the variety of services and applications that we provide on an a la carte basis. So they pay for them as such. And then once they are a member of that component, teaching and learning, then yes, when a teacher needs a class, they simply go to that. So Hopkins or Eden Prairie, in your case, were members and they were part of that component, then they would just send their staff and it would just be incorporated into that fee. Did I get to that?
Representative Loon.
I think so. So I think what I'm hearing you say is that for those specific services, the school district would provide funds for those services, and that would come out of their general funds, and that are part of their teaching and learning budget, whereas the levy is something that is separate.
The test
perfectly
that right?
Set, yes.
Yes, okay.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had one additional question, and I think it's more for our researcher staff. I'm looking at the previous chart that was run on Sparsity. I know a completely separate subject, and this, and it shows a vastly different pupil unit number. And I'm trying to reconcile that for my school district. One is like 11,000, one is 9,000, and so.
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Representative Loon, the Sparsity printout showed the average daily membership, which is the unweighted count of pupils, and it was adjusted, which means the served pupils. So that's unweighted by grade level. The pupil unit that the building lease is determined on is what we call weighted average daily membership, and that's weighted by grade level and its resident. So the number for your district on that will reflect all secondary kids counting as 1.3 and the 4th to 6th graders counting at 1.06 and the 1st through 3rd graders counting at 1.15, but it's also resident, not adjusted or served. So there's two different measures. The lease levy currently is limited to no more than $150 per pupil, and the pupil count they use is weighted average daily membership.
Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification on the actual cost. So if a new district wanted to get into TIES, what would be the cost to them? And I understand it would be a per pupil cost.
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, representatives, yes, there would be, right now, the cost of membership, there's a buy-in fee, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, that would be their application into that membership. And then once done, there's this, historically up to this point, for the last 10 years, there's been this levy piece. So at a minimum, there would be that. It's some small amount for the membership. These new districts coming on are coming on to save costs and to gain integration. So to extend your question a little bit, they would then pay for our student system on a per student basis, our finance HR system at some later point, also our data warehouse and some of our test assessment tools. All of those are a la carte, and they would pay for those. So at the base level, they would pay for that membership, and then they would historically then paying that levy amount, which is a relatively small amount, now spread amongst more districts, and then they would add on an a la carte basis the different features and services that they might use.
Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just more curious about the operation as far as if someone wanted to come in and buy in ownership now. Certainly it would have to be a different rate for someone coming in now. It'd have to be prorated for the expense that all the other districts have gone into, and that's more along what I was curious about.
The testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, there's a calculation that we use, and I don't have that in front of me right now, but it's not insurmountable, however.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Then to the referendum, I assume that this would still be up to the districts as to whether to incorporate the referendum, or they could come up with a lump sum figure if actually they did have reserves?
The testifier. Mr. Chair and members, no. Each district, by essentially agreeing to this approach, has signed on to a lease levy approach. It doesn't go into individual referenda in each community. And so essentially what the member districts are saying is this is a better approach to finance capital improvements than coming out of their operating funds and you know, making that type of contribution.
So they would, excuse me, Mr. Chair, so they would have to incorporate this referendum?
Yes, this is not, once the ties
or levy,
the members agree that this is, that they want to sponsor this legislation, this is the program for financing these capital improvements. And as Mr. Baufield said, it's relatively modest per household or per pupil unit, but once the board acts and the legislature responds, then it's essentially done for the next 10 years. It's kind of like taking out a mortgage. Once those details are in place, that's the way it's financed over that 10-year period.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I was saying referendum, I meant levy.
Oh, okay.
We know it was not a referendum.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Quam, I was waiting for the rest of your question. I thought you were going to ask the question about, when you asked the question about what do the other 300 school districts do, I thought you were talking about with their hole in the roof and when their air conditioner doesn't work and their heating doesn't work. And I thought that you were talking about, Representative Quam. And so, you know, obviously, Ties does a great job, and I really respect and appreciate what you do. But wouldn't it be nice, members, if it would be nice if all of our buildings in the state of Minnesota, you know, had the ability to, you know, have this happen to them as well when our buildings are leaking in the roof and their air conditioner, their furnace system isn't working, and things as such. So I just thought you were going to ask that question, Representative Quam.
Any other questions? Representative Loon.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I have one more question. So the funds or fees or whatever you want to call it that the district pay for participation, would that come from their, potentially from their staff development funds, or is that separate from that?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, representatives, for the piece that we're seeking here, it would not be anywhere attached to the professional development. For other services like the teaching and learning component, they could elect to use professional development dollars for training services, but that does not, you would never use you would not use professional development dollars for what we're seeking here.
Representative Loon.
Thank you. Yes, and I kind of assumed that much, but I'm just wondering if you happen to know of your 41 member participating districts, if most of them for the fees for the, you know, programs and that their staff and teachers may participate in, is that, does that generally come? And it's maybe more of an anecdotal question, but if you happen to know that.
To testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that most of this is a general fund item. There may be exceptions to that where they might use certain components of the professional development dollars. It certainly could apply. I don't know that we sitting here would know where all 41 use or seek those dollars. I couldn't comment on that in whole.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bills.
I did ask my superintendent, Representative Loon, I did ask my superintendent. I believe that he said it comes out of the general fund, their fees do.
Representative Loon.
Thank you. And just one additional question to clarify. So all of your current participating districts, they have all endorsed this proposal that you're bringing forward, is that correct?
Yes.
The testifiers. Representative Loon?
Thank you.
Any other questions for members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Bills, do you have any closing comments?
I would just, thank you for listening and sharing your questions. And then I did notice that House files tend to take on their author's last name, so I was wondering, Mr. Chairman, then this would be known as what then, Mr. Chairman?
Now, this is the Bills bill.
Okay.
With that, Representative Bills renews his motion at House File 1040 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Members, one quick announcement. The committee will come back at 5 p.m. tonight. We're in this room, in room 5. Is there any Representative Eric?
Mr. Chair, why don't we hear my 947 right now?
Representative Eric said, I believe it's because we posted that we are going to be hearing it at 5. Mm. And if I could get the consent, unanimous consent of the state of Minnesota to have us hear that bill right now, I would do that.
Well, it's just that I have a committee at the same time, but I understand.
I know, but we got to follow. I would. Can we do that or not? Can we hear it right now, Representative Brown?
Mr. Chair, I don't know who's going to complain about it, but it won't be me.
One second.
Thank you.
Okay. I am told that there are members of the public who wish to testify on the bill. So, any other comments or questions for members of the committee? With that, we are recessed to the call of the chair. Thank you. Members will reconvene this meeting of the Education and Finance Committee. We have one item left on the agenda, House File 947. Representative Erickson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 947 is a dramatic change to alternative teacher pay. It is moving us into the 21st century and is basically a reform that aligns, I think, with what we're going to achieve this session, and that's some kind of statewide teacher appraisal system. So in Section 1 of the bill, called the Transitional Planning Year, I have eliminated some of the little-used items by districts when they apply for quality compensation, as we typically call it, QCOMP. Under the proposed changes, school districts and charter schools are still required to plan for a transition, but they don't have to seek a waiver from the Commissioner of Education to do so. So that's basically cleanup language, Mr. Chair. Any new QCOMP plan or changes to an existing QCOMP plan would require a contractual vote, making it unnecessary to conduct two separate votes. Lastly, the language removes the requirement to use the staff development set-aside funds and gives districts flexibility to use other funds. So that takes care of Section 1, Subdivision 2A. In Section 2, Subdivision 2, the bill requires that all school districts, intermediate school districts, and charter school districts submit and receive approval for a new QCOMP plan by 2014-2015 school year. school districts and charter schools currently in the program will be required to submit a new application to the department, and all school districts and charter schools will be required to submit their applications by June 1 of 2013 in order to receive approval for the 2014 school year or approval by October of 2014. In that same subdivision, all school districts, intermediate school districts, and charter schools must make the following changes to the salary schedule. They must establish an alternative salary schedule that utilizes methods other than seniority and either partially or fully embeds performance pay. So it isn't necessary to do the full meal deal. At least 50% of the teacher pay increases must be based on student performance. 25% of that on school-wide achievement gains using the state assessments, and 25% based on student achievement gains using the state assessment or a local standardized assessment. The other 50% would be based on the teacher evaluations that align with our new teacher effectiveness evaluation system. And another goal of that subdivision is to improve beginning teacher salaries. Section 3, Subdivision 2A, removes the requirement that charter schools secure 70% support for their QCOMP plan. Typically, charter schools submit teacher petitions to the department in order to the department in support of the provision, and charter school teachers typically don't refuse to sign the petition, so that seems to be an unnecessary part of present law that could be removed. Section 4, Subdivision 2, moves for required participation from all school districts, intermediate school districts, and charter schools to participate in alternative teacher pay, and then gives the department additional time to process the applications. Section 5 is again the requirement that any school district, intermediate school district, or charter school that has presently an approved alternative teacher compensation plan submit a new application to the commissioner by June 1st of 2013. So, Mr. Chair, those are the dramatic changes, reforms to quality compensation. I think most of these are very, very good changes, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. This is a public hearing. If there's any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill, now would be the time to come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Paul.
Hi. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Julie Blaha, and I'm the president of Anoka Hennepin Education Minnesota. Chair Garofalo, members of the committee, Representative Anderson, Erickson, thank you. As many of you know, our district recently considered a QCOMP proposal, and we spent the past year working out the details of the program. So as a result, we've learned a lot about the costs of implementing a program like this. My concern about this bill is that the infrastructure required will bring considerable costs to local districts. Let me just lay out some of the very basics of our proposal so we can discuss those costs. We based it on the plans that are most commonly currently in place, like you see in Osseo or Mounds View right now. We provided incentives for a school-wide test score goal, a student achievement goal based on individual teacher students, and demonstrating instructional skills via a set of three annual observations. The incentives were broken down with 10% based on the school-wide goal, 10% on the individual goal, and 80% on the observation goal. Now, the observations would be performed by administrators, our current administrators, once every 4 years and during probation. The other 3 years, peer evaluators, people hired specifically for that purpose, would perform the other evaluations, with one of those evaluations being performed by a peer of your choice, one that does as close to as possible what you do in your classroom. Teachers who worked less than a 40% assignment were not included in this plan. So basically, this is akin to the minimum of two observations that you see in the requirements in other parts of statute. So it's a pretty standard program. So here's how the cost shook out. We would need to observe 2,400 more teachers annually than we do currently. To do that, we calculated we would need to hire 30 full-time evaluators, each responsible for about 80 teachers per year. Now, to be fair, the Minnesota Department of Education cautioned us that this ratio actually might be a bit high. We'd also need two people to administer the program, one administrator, one teacher on special assignment, basically to manage and approve goals, approve incentives, work with the MDE, manage the paperwork. We also need to add two people to manage payroll and data and other paperwork. Mileage, printing, and some other miscellaneous costs also contributed a small percentage to this. So, altogether, those just infrastructure costs were estimated to be $3.2 million annually for the Anoka-Hennepin District. Now, without state funding and only using a local levy, that would leave about our local levy at $91 per student. Our local levy would have been about $3.5 million. Without a state portion of funding, that would leave about $300,000 for incentives, which would translate to about $120 per person. Now, if the school board were unwilling to raise a levy, now something else in the district would clearly need to be cut to cover the infrastructure costs for this program. Now, in our district, we're facing class sizes next year that will be over 30 students in elementary, over 40 in secondary. And frankly, that was the biggest reason that if people voted against our proposal, they did. They were concerned that the money would be better used for class size reduction than for a bonus system. Also, most of our members, you know, most of our members had salaries frozen last year. We recently cut an additional $3 million from the budget. Frankly, we are simply running out of places to cut. I don't know where we'd find another $3.2 million to provide the infrastructure for a mandatory QCOM plan. So I urge you to consider this bill very carefully. Without an appropriation to cover the costs it will mandate, I believe it'll put us in a really tough spot. Thank you.
Are there questions for members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Blaha, if I heard you correctly, the Anoka-Hennepin District, it would cost them $3.2 million to implement this, if this bill is put into legislation, passed, to put in that QCOM, this program.
To put in, just for the infrastructure, that would not count any incentives or any changes to pay. That would simply cover the people needed to simply make the program work, the people to do observations, paperwork, and administer the program.
So,
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Erickson, the bill, obviously, the districts that are currently on QComp are all going to have to change plans, are all going to have to make tweaks to their plans. Do you know how much that's going to cost? You know, we heard $3.2 million, I think, in Anoka. Do you know statewide what is that going to cost to districts?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Ward, I believe Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom prepared these numbers, and they will share those with us at this time.
Mr. Crow?
Madam Chair and members, we estimate that if all the districts when all the districts qualify, it would be about $131 million of aid and of revenue. Of that, $35 million approximately would be raised in local levy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward again.
Thank you. So, you know, one of the things that I've frequently said, Representative Erickson, about QComp is that all the districts in the state of Minnesota don't have the labor intensity to apply for the program, and it's, you know, it is creating a system, again, of have and have nots, those that can and those that can't. But, you know, I also know that there are districts in the state of Minnesota that have voted down to not have QComp. And, you know, so aren't we putting another state mandate on those districts that have said, no, we don't want QComp in our district? Isn't this another state mandate, an unfunded mandate?
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, if we're going to move into the 21st century with a teacher appraisal, and that piece is covered in half of this new alternative professional pay system, then we have half of that taken care of through that channel. The other half is then
to a certain extent, prescribed in that I'm asking that we look at growth in our student performance. But that's also already occurring. So there is data available, and the department has their longitudinal piece in place. So what I see is in 2014, 2015, that's when the additional dollars would be needed. If districts vote against this, then they're voting against moving into the 21st century, which I think is going to demand that we reward our highly effective, our effective teachers to the best degree we can. And yes, it's going to take more money. In 14 and 15, yes, and hopefully by then the economy will have turned around. But this is a direction we should move in so that we are looking at excellence in teaching and what excellent teachers do to raise achievement, increase learning among our students, which is our goal, to close the achievement gap. And then I think that can be the end game that we achieve in moving in this direction. I don't know if we can accomplish all of this right away, but we have to think in terms of this is what we need to move toward. And no longer would I say do steps and lanes achieve what it is we're striving for. We're striving to reward excellence in education. And this has been the program that has tried to do that, although I would argue that one of the reasons that teacher performance pay needs to be reformed is that districts have been all over the place on what it is they have required for those additional dollars. And in my former district, every teacher received the same amount of reward. And I question that because I didn't see evidence that every one of my former colleagues or the new teachers on the block in my former district had probably risen to the level of highly effective or excellent. So we can't continue with the program, I guess is what I'm trying to say, that status quo. There have to be some changes. This is a suggestion of change. But if teachers have voted it down in the past, I think it's because, you know, it's a lot of work. But the work should be accomplished partly now through the teacher appraisal system. So I don't foresee that we're going to need an infrastructure that is going to cost that much. But, you know, I'm here for suggestions, and I appreciate your question.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. Just a couple quick follow-through, please, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Representative Erickson, so if I heard you correctly, though, you said that if the staff votes this down, but they, according to your House File 947, everybody... It's not voluntary. It's mandated. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
It is, yes. And I was talking about the past, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Okay, I want
about having voted down plans. But no, not starting in 2014, 2015. Moving to either partially or fully based on performance would be the pay system.
And then
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then have the school districts that are currently in QComp, do we have data that shows that they have indeed closed the achievement gap, that it is working, that QComp is working and closing the achievement gap?
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, there is not the ability to compare or even to answer your question because there's no definitive data that's been collected in many instances of quality compensation or the alternative teacher pay performance. There are pieces of it, and you heard Anoka just describe what they would do, and you hear 10% here and, you know, 25% here, but there has to be a system developed, and the department would be the key designer of that to assist districts. Because the teacher appraisal system, if what we have proposed before us now, is going to require that.
And then one final question.
Representative Ward.
And Mr. Chair, this is for you, or maybe Representative Erickson. Are we voting on this bill tonight, or is this laid
this
over?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, this is information only.
Thank you.
You seem relieved.
More questions, Representative Grinding.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson. I may have missed it, but did you say whatever figure Mr. Crow was throwing out there, 100 and some $31 million. $31 million. Okay, where did I get the 100? Anyway, $31 million is what this bill is going to cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, if this were enacted in 2014 and 2015, when this would be a mandate, teacher performance pay, it would cost $131 million, 35 of that levy. Yes, this is...
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it was $131 million. Okay. My ears are better than I thought, but it's not taking effect until the next biennium. Kind of like that Representative Peterson's bill. We're kind of mandating for the next set of legislators in these last couple of days. But you intend to pay for it. So, because I'm thinking when we have the testifier from Anoka Hennepin, I read your quotes in the paper, which I thought were laudable, that Anoka Hennepin voted down QComp, what was it, 59%, and your contract calls for 75%, and you forfeited $7 or $8 million because teachers just thought that, if I've got it right with what I remember from your quote, I didn't know you're going to be testifying here today, that you thought it should be for students when there isn't enough money to go around. And so it just seems like a kick in the teeth then to be mandated to do it if it wasn't going to be funded. But now Representative Erickson tells me she does plan to fund it, so that's better than an unfunded mandate. I just question whether we should be doing all these things that get funded in the next biennium. It seems to me we should either put it in this biennium and fund it, or wait until the next biennium. As you know, I always we did put the new Minnesota Miracle in that regard because it was a big mammoth funding system. But I always resisted and held off from anybody wanting to put policy in that bill. Many people did want to put policy in there and put that off for the, and I always said that should be for the next legislators. But the only reason to put a funding system in the out years is because it had to be phased in over time, because you couldn't fund anything like that one fell swoop. But this now would be policy, putting policy in the out years. And so I'm just going to say, I think that to put policy in the out years and all the worst policy that's going to cost money in the out years should wait for the out years.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Bryan, Representative Erickson,
thank you for your statement. I appreciate it.
Another question from Representative Dabney.
Really?
You've got to ask one now.
Gosh, Mr. Chair, can I have a minute to come up with one?
You're on the list, but...
Can I reserve that for later? I'm sure I'll have a question at some point.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is for Ms. Blaha. So the way I heard your testimony is that you went through the different costs that Anoka Hennepin thought that it would be to implement this program, but I am missing the point of, are you in support of the bill or not?
Currently, you know, without an appropriation, no. Also, I would suggest that, kind of on what my members were saying, and maybe I need to be a little bit more clear, the full cost of our program would have been $10.2 million if you included the incentive portion. The $3.2 million is only to run the program without any incentive, just to keep it moving. But again, $10.2 million to run it with the incentives that are similar to other groups. Our members had, basically, their statement was, as we met, as we talked over and over again, was, if we have an extra, in this case, $131 million, we would rather see that money go to class size reduction, to reducing caseloads, to things that go more directly to our students. When we're looking at budget cuts, they're saying that, you know, no, though there are things about QComp we're very supportive of, the idea of getting good feedback every year, big fan of that. The idea of having peers that know our work really well giving us feedback, again, people were very strongly supportive of that. Test score portions people struggled with because many of our members are simply not attached to a standardized test score. At one point for a school-wide goal, we assessed that over 60% of the teachers would not directly be impacted by that school-wide goal, but may still be paid for it. Ultimately, if we would rather see the money go for class size reduction than for an incentive program at this point. So unless there is money available for class size reduction, I would be willing to change that statement, I believe. But it's, as it stands, if we are going to be facing class size of over 30 and over 40 in the upcoming years, we would rather see the money go there. So I'm speaking against the bill.
Any follow-up? No. Representative?
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to, I don't know enough of the nuances of this bill to know whether I would support it or not, but let me just say one thing, is that I applaud Representative Erickson for bringing something forward that takes something we have already started and brings it to the state level, as opposed to layering on a new requirement, a new mandate. The districts that are in QComp seem to like it. They don't want to get rid of it, no matter which party we're in. And so I have to at least say that I think it's applaudable to say at least you've taken a structure that we already have and improving it and making sure that all districts have access to it. So from that standpoint, I appreciate that. I'm very pleasantly surprised, actually. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dietrich, for those remarks. I think we have to keep in mind that the 50%, that I'm focusing on in this reform, 25% of that is on school-wide achievement gains. That's growth. So when we say it's going to teachers, of course it should go to teachers because they teach our children. And the children are going to be the recipients of this motivation, this new skill, this new knowledge, whatever it is that the teacher is going to do in the classroom to move the children ahead. And that's what we're trying to work for, is achievement gains. And then the other the school-wide achievement. So there's school-wide achievement gains and individual student achievement gains. Those work together because we want to focus on not only the individual students, but what teachers are doing as a collegial group within their school. And so I see this as a great incentive, not on the side of the dollar so much, but the reward that teachers are going to gain themselves, knowing that they moved our children out of that abysmal level of not achieving to a higher standard and closing that achievement gap, especially in our school districts where we have such a need. And I know that Minneapolis uses TAP, and I think that that could continue to be used because it's a good program. But at the same time, to give teachers this ability to know that when I do excellent work, I'm going to know because of my student achievement, my school achievement, and I'm also going to get a little incentive there in pay.
I have a question
Mr.
now
Chairman,
from Representative.
Can I follow up?
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Dietrich, go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to also then comment that to Ms. Blaha. I think what you have outlined in the QComp, what the teachers voted on, I think actually sounds like a very solid plan. And I also commend you for whatever role you played in that. And I am extremely disappointed, though, that the teachers did not accept it. It sounds like a really solid plan to me. So thank you.
Comment?
One of the concerns, I have to say, though, the plan we passed, I don't think would be is different than the plan that we would need to resubmit. I think that one of the concerns that that we faced was simply on the standardized test portion, that we're asking for standardized tests. We only have standardized tests in math, reading, science, not every year. A lot of teachers found it a bit illogical. I had an art teacher tell me to be paid for math scores, because you only pick one. You pick one goal for your building. So if you pick a math goal in a high school, a lot of teachers will say, I teach art and I talk about symmetry, but frankly, it really doesn't. It feels a little wrong for me to be getting a couple $100 for that goal. Or a teacher that teaches students with significant developmental disabilities. None of their students will ever take one of these tests in some cases. They may not ever work with a student that does. So that disconnect felt like, money for test scores might be better used in another way. And so I think that, well, we had it as 10% and 10%. I think people could say, okay, I can deal with that. That I can do. 80% is what you can observe, exactly what I'm doing, what is absolutely in my control, and I'm absolutely fully accountable for. I think if it had the test, I had the standard been 25% and 25%. And again, for an individual score needing to be on a standardized test when many subjects simply don't have one, would have been much more problematic and then much more difficult for people to say yes to.
Representative?
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Okay. I had a question, too, and I read the article in the paper about the vote at your school, and it actually had a 59% passing rate. Is that a higher bar for this particular voter? Is that the way all of your votes go when you do those things, ma'am?
Well, we have a higher bar for alternative compensation. I think kind of like you see with the charter schools having a 70% of all the members. We actually had 75% of those voting. I'm also do some parliamentary work, so I'm really excited to talk about this, probably more so than I should be. But so actually, when you look at where with a 72% turnout, we actually had 42.7% of our members casting yes ballots. So we didn't actually have half the people actually saying yes to it. Now, again, I think that higher standard was to make sure that we weren't setting up a system that would only work for, say, just the classroom teachers or just secondary teachers, which, frankly, would have been easy to do. We wanted to make sure that we had a lot of buy-in. And even though we don't have the standard in our regular contracts, normally our contracts pass at a rate of 85% or more, and even the last contract, which had a pay freeze in it, passed at over 90%. So it's typical for us to have a very high pass rate as a union.
Okay, thank you. Representative Peterson, next.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify a point that was made since someone, I think Representative Greiling referred to House File 945, and I just want to make sure that accurate information is out there as it relates to that there was somehow a mandate that was being pushed out into the future, and while that's true, the policy was actually going to take effect in the 11-12 school year. So, you know, it just would be impossible to implement the framework and have performance management measures also take effect immediately. You have to build the framework. We allow for plenty of local control. So it's not something that's put out into the next biennium. It actually takes effect in the next school year. I just wanted to clarify that.
Thanks, Representative. Yep. And now Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to speak a little further on the data issues. I think the goals of this bill are laudable in that I've been a proponent for a long time for a performance-based pay scale, but the connection to the 25% on school-wide student achievement is data that we currently have available, and I don't see anyone in the audience that could testify to this point, but I believe that the 25% on student achievement connected to the individual teacher is not available, and is not only not available, but is challenged by our own assessment people in our school districts as being able to be, even through the longitudinal data system, reliably connected to a teacher without a very low confidence interval. So I think we need people from the department here to speak to the mechanics here, but I've heard a number of assessment people that are very concerned about attaching these percentages in advance of a lot of additional assessment work and maybe even a shift in the type of testing that we're going to use if we're going to connect that achievement score to the individual teacher. So that's my area of concern.
Representative Erickson, a comment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Briner, you know, I certainly understand what you're saying, and I wish that you could have heard Representative Peterson's teacher appraisal bill before this, because maybe that would help you understand better why I've chosen to go in this direction. But, I think the landscape may be changing in the testing area. These are suggestions I have, but at the same time, if you had attended our hearing last night on Representative Peterson's bill and heard the strong support of data collection and how we need to move in the direction of longitudinal, you know, we're going to have to get there, I think. And under what kind of testing it is, I think, is still probably questionable. But in the end, the data that we collect on our students is essential to teachers to know how to move the student forward, and it's essential to parents to know whether their children are learning. And I'll just point to math and reading and how essential those are. And if we're not going to work hard as teachers to ensure that our children are reading, let's say, by third grade, at the third grade level, then we have missed out on their success in the future. So we have to look at something. What that's going to be, I'm really not sure. But these are my suggestions here.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree totally with you, and I've been about data-driven research-based systems for the 20 years I've been involved in public education, you know, and I've worked aggressively on in my own community with assessments, and the kind of reporting you do happens in my community in terms of teachers using their assessment data in the classroom to address individual student needs, and parents are reported to on that, and parents work with teachers on that data. But it's a different issue to turn that body of data around in terms of tying the data that follows the individual student to the individual teacher and being able to hold a high level of statistical reliability. And I have read Representative Peterson's bill, and I have some of these same issues with his bill, and I'm very concerned that we're putting the cart before the horse, because to attach numbers to these issues in advance of the work we need to do with assessment experts, to me, is just a mistake. To say that we have goals of having a teacher appraisal system, but to say that 50% or 25% should come from a certain data source, we need at the table the assessment experts who say what is possible and how it can be done. Right now, there's a lot of concerns about whether the MCA should be the basis on which we make that judgment. And that's a huge decision for our state, let alone for individual districts, if we are going to either interface another type of testing like the MAP testing or NWEA. So I just think attaching the numbers and setting a time deadline is very premature. It's not that I don't support the goals of your bill, but the specifics, I think, are unwarranted at this time.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Briner. I based this off what I knew Representative Peterson was doing in his teacher appraisal bill, so there would be continuity, so they'd match up. And so this is where we are today. I'm not sure where we'll be tomorrow or the next week or the next week, but this is a snapshot of what I think could be for a dramatic change in quality compensation, which in the end is going to help our children because it's going to improve teaching. And I really believe that it will increase learning, and teachers should be rewarded. And if you've read Representative Peterson's bill, you know that when we look at value added and the Sanders model, for example, and I'm sure you're familiar with that because we had those debates back in probably 2005, but at some point the focus will be on what has happened to that student based on who his or her teacher was and to what extent they were able to move that student forward. I don't think that's something that our profession should fear. I would, welcome the opportunity to return to that setting and see how this works. And maybe that's what I'll have to do to find out whether this is even going to work. So,
Representative,
thank you for your comments.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I commend Representative Erickson for putting this forward and really literally putting our money where our mouth is when it comes to education. That being said, this is a very difficult situation for me to be in this hearing because, we're not looking at House File 945, we're looking at House File 947, and we're kind of debating the merits in an intertangled manner, and it's very difficult for me to justify or to defend the elements of my bill. And I just want to state that there is going to be a separate hearing, and everyone knows that, on that bill, and that, you know, I hope that we can try to focus on the elements of this bill and allow that other concept, which is different from this, and it's not, you know, there's a reason they're two separate pieces of legislation. allow that bill to have its own, you know, thorough hearing. And it was very thorough last night. I think it was 3 hours and 45
it was
minutes.
4 hours, Representative.
Yeah, and we could, and we'll do it all over again in here. But it's, you know, I just, I feel compelled to get involved, and I just want to state that these are two separate items, two separate authors, you know, there may be some like concepts, but not, you know, they're not one and the same. So that's all that I wanted to say.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to comment on Representative Peter's statements because he's right. His bill is separate, and it's a different bill and a different proposal. But another important feature of changing performance pay is our recognition that we have many young teachers or teachers new to our school districts who are last hired but first fired, if I may be that crass. You can't imagine the number of emails I've gotten in the last 2 days. I thought the heavens opened because I have, you know, probably 500 emails about this request that we protect beginning teachers. And so, you know, I'm writing back with my responses, telling them, yeah, well, I'm working on this. But nevertheless, a performance pay system will not dump those teachers, if I may use that kind of verb. Instead, it will look at what they've done in the classroom. And I think that's so important today, that we reward our tenured teachers, our veteran teachers, but that we also look carefully at the new talent that's coming into the classroom. And with a steps and lane salary schedule, they are going to be the first to leave us, and they may be the saviors of some of our children.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Brenner, I think you raised a really good point about the longitudinal data system. And I don't know if we've had any presentations in either the reform or the K-12 Finance Committee. And I don't know, Representative Peterson, if perhaps you deal with this as part of the overall set of testifiers and things on your bill. But I do know from the time that I spent on this P20 partnership commission the last 2 years that we are making progress. I think that's about a $12 million investment by MDE to build that longitudinal data system. And if I remember right, somewhere along the way in the reports that we got, they talked about being able to attach teachers to those longitudinal student records, but my recollection was that maybe the first phase of the implementation might not have that either done or completely done, so it might be interesting to hear from them somewhere along the way. But I guess I'd argue for not letting that hold us back. In fact, I think probably both of these bills, Representative Peterson's and Representative Erickson's, would be the catalyst to make sure that that does get fully implemented in a way that could be used. And if we do have a little bit of a lead time here, hopefully the longitudinal data system would be there. And if not, I don't think the language is so prescriptive here that we'd have to have, you know, the airtight nuclear submarine of longitudinal data. The districts appear to me to be able to have some flexibility or could use local tools or local assessment methods to figure out something that's right size for the local district to make sure that those percentage allocations to the student achievement can be measured with enough accuracy that the districts can make good decisions about their QCOP plan. So anyway, I think a good, really good point and something we might want to educate ourselves a little bit and make sure we, from the legislative standpoint, keep that longitudinal data system advancing at a pace that we want and need for some of these pieces of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative. And a follow-up by Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that incentive for getting. We should probably have someone, Kathy Wagner from MDE, come and testify on the state of the longitudinal data system. But I have two different issues. One is the longitudinal data system, but the other is we need to hear from our assessment experts about the data that's in that system and whether the data itself, even linked to the individual students, will give us a fair profile of teacher effectiveness, because you've got a small sample that this is, and I'm not an expert in this area, but I've heard hundreds of hours of conversation around issues around confidence intervals with the small sample and whether the MCA data, which is a systems check, not an individual student achievement score, will give us what we're looking for. So I think we need both of those things, not just a speed up of the longitudinal data, which will give us data, but is it the right data? When we have a lot of great minds in Minnesota that can help us answer that question about whether we have the data to do the kind of analysis we intend to do with teacher effectiveness.
And Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Briner, the department is moving, I think, very successfully in that direction. We did hear from Kathy Wagner in our reform committee, and also from Amy Gadira from Data Quality. I think that we can be very optimistic, and hopefully when the commissioner is before us, we'll find out exactly where they are and to what extent we can start looking at the piece that I think all of us are concerned about.
Representative Peterson.
It was to Downey's point. Okay.
Sorry, I missed you.
That's fine, yeah.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general comment to Representative Erickson. Thanks as well for bringing this forward, and I think it's good discussions to have. I have some things I'm a little cautious about. Number one, one size doesn't fit all, and we need to make sure that we create flexibility within a system, whatever it is, that allows an Okehennepin to be successful, but it also allows Lancaster and Roseau to be successful in this stuff. So I'm always a little cautious when these types of things come forward, because I do know that it's, and you've heard, I'm beating this dead horse again, but things are different out in rural Minnesota. They really are. And I'm not one that wants to put some mandates on local school boards and administrators that really handcuff them in some cases unintendedly prevent them from delivering the services that they really are best at delivering, which is educating students. There have to be some models available, and as Representative Brainerd says, we need to proceed somewhat cautiously. I think you said something like that, and that's just my comment. Thank you.
Any other questions from members of the committee? What about testimony from anybody else in the audience who would care to speak? Welcome, and identify yourself, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alsweiger, Education Minnesota. I missed the first few minutes of the hearing. I do want to make sure that people understand that those school districts that are already in QComp that have developed their own program would have to be in by submit a new application to the commissioner to meet the new standards in this bill by June 1st of 2013, and then anybody else who already doesn't have a QComp plan would then have to be in by for 2014-15 school year. So this is a mandatory QComp. One of the reasons that QComp has worked is because it's voluntary and because it's locally developed and designed, as Representative Fabian was mentioning. We think that that's very important. It creates a level of trust and ownership buy-in so that they feel it is their own plan that they agree to. So we believe that this is more of a state mandate that is prescribed and how it works. I also think that maybe this is a little mistake, I'm not sure, but if you look on page three, line 3.6, it references teacher evaluations required under section 122A.411. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that might be a Representative Peterson's bill. And if that's the case, would then we have 100% tied to test scores? And so we might want to, if this is an informational hearing, we've got time to think about that. So it's just information for you to look at and to analyze it.
Well, they have to pay the teachers.
Right. And we have concerns because this removes the 2% staff development set aside. One of the reasons that the QCOM plan has been embraced by some of our local districts is because of the professional support for funding that they have received, so that they could get the support, staff development time, substitutes coming in so they could review, watch other teachers or people coming in to review them. A lot of this was staff development money. So how would you pay for this QComp program in a district that hasn't started anything? It takes a tremendous amount of time, a significant amount of money to start a new program. So we think that that is a problem as well. On line 2.26, it is the basically elimination of steps and lanes, and you know we are going to differ on that, but we believe that you could have a component possibly of steps and lanes, or maybe a district of the teachers want to get rid of it. They could. In the current QCOM plan, they can totally get rid of it. But we don't think that this should be mandated. And we think that overall, as Education Minnesota testified when Governor Pawlenty first proposed QCOM, and from day one, Education Minnesota has said that we support the possibility of a school district teachers going into QCOM. It should be voluntary. There should be sufficient funding for every program and sufficient funding for every district that wanted to get into it. We had some other qualifications, and for the most part, everything was met. And we felt that there are some good programs out there, and I think in some of the testimony that you'll probably hear tomorrow, you'll see some very good things that have happened. But it is because it was locally designed to fit the needs of the district and the teacher. So we have concerns about the prescriptiveness of this language, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee members? See none, thank you, Ms. Oshwager. Any other testimony from members of the public? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland, and I represent the intermediate school districts. And just for your information, let me briefly describe what the intermediate school districts are. There are three of them in the metropolitan area. They are designated in statute. Individual school districts belong to the intermediate school districts. The three in the metro area, there's one in the East Metro, which is made up of school districts such as South Washington County, Stillwater, Spring Lake Park, Moundsview, etc. There's one in the West Metro area, which is made up of Richfield, Brooklyn Center, Edina, Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, Robbinsdale, Osseo, among several others. And then lastly, there's one in the South Metro area, which is made up of Burnsville, Farmington, Hastings, Invergrove Heights, Lakeville, and a few more school districts as well. And intermediate school districts provide services to the member districts primarily in the areas of career and tech education and special education, but they do a number of other things. They run area learning centers. They run a gifted and talented program. They also provide North Star Online, which is an online learning program. And they do hire, obviously, licensed teachers. They operate similar to a regular school district. They hire licensed teachers, and they negotiate contracts with teachers, and they are subject to the January 15th penalty. And the QCOM statutes, and I've already talked with Representative Erickson about this, and I appreciate her willingness to listen to our concerns. The QCOM statutes say that intermediate districts can participate in QCOM, but the formula to generate the revenue is based on the number of students that are enrolled in a school district, and intermediate districts do not have pupils that are, for the most part, do not have pupils that are enrolled because the pupils they serve are enrolled in their member school districts. And as a result, the formula does not generate enough revenue for the intermediate districts to be able to enter into a negotiation with their member districts. And we have had legislation for the last several years to change that formula. And this year, Representative McFarland is the author of the bill. We didn't bring it forward because there was a fiscal note But Representative Erickson brought forward this bill, which gave me the opportunity to bring this discussion to the committee. So we do have a bill that was introduced by Representative McFarland and Representative Slocum signed on to it that changes the formula just for the intermediates so that the revenue generated is based on the number of teachers rather than the number of pupils.
And any questions?
Sorry. And I hope that this is something that Representative Erickson, should this bill move forward with the funding that Representative Erickson talked about, I hope that the intermediate issue can be addressed.
Comments, questions, Representative Erickson?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dozlin and I did talk, and I think this is a good idea if we go forward with the funding.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. Any other testimony from members of the audience? Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Rick Heller. I'm up here representing those who are underrepresented, print disabled, and twice exceptional. Just so you know, I usually work closely with Anoka Hennepin, and they do use a model, a MAP testing, to identify their kids at risk regarding RIT scores on the MAP testing, and also to identify kids that are gifted. So they are using one of the components of triangulation, which is an important part of identification for when it comes to making sense of test data, just like the how, what, and why of learning. Frankly, that's about universal design for learning. Once again, you just can't take one piece of data. And definitely the department to have a meaningful conversation regarding this. I think that would be helpful for regarding this. Also, the district has always used the MAP testing on my child's IEP as a progress monitoring tool. And it was growth model. So this is a practice they've used for years. As you all know, Minnesota doesn't have made specific standards when it comes to what we have, what's called in bands. But because we've gone to the modified assessment, which is the MCAM, we are required to create grade specific standards because they're looking at specific mastery in grades. Once again, part of the value added assessment part, which is probably another part of the triangulation piece. Once again, I'll say this again. This is merit pay, and No Child Left Behind asked for that to be part of checking progress and with teachers as they continue to improve their learning, just like a child learns. And once again, I just think that's a point of information, so I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Heller. Next testifier. Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I work for the Minnesota School Boards Association. We have been anxiously sort of watching the progress of this bill go through, and MSBA helped write the original underlying QCOMP language. And we really did feel it was a place that school districts and their teachers would get that they could go forward and implement. We have a little bit of concern that this goes statewide, financially, as well as the ability of some of our districts to achieve this plan. I have no argument with the merit of the program, but it's just going to be really tough in some areas. So I want to be on the record as being somewhat concerned about the finances and how the money works and how what happens when we reach impasse and we can't get this done. Where else would we go? How would we find our way through this? So please keep that in mind as these bills go forward when you look at this issue. Thank you.
Questions or comments? Thanks, Ms. Kelleher. Any other testimony from either committee members or those in the audience? If not, any final thoughts, Representative Erickson?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for this informational hearing, and I believe the bill will be before the committee officially sometime in the future.
Thank you. With that, the meeting is adjourned.